So as I said, this is the Kula Siha Nada Sutta. Kula is the sh means the short one. Siha is a lion, and Nada is the roar. So this is the shorter discourse on the lion's roar, which is the lion's roar is a phrase you hear in Buddhist teaching in various situations. And basically, in this particular discourse, what the Buddha is doing is explaining to his disciples how they should respond to monks of other traditions who ask why the Buddha's teachings are any better than the ones they follow. First of all, I have to remember in the Buddhist time, this is, 2,500 years ago in North India, there were a lot of different teachings and teachers and sects of sadhus and monks and nuns. Who all had very sometimes quite distinctly different teachings, and there was always this sort of almost competitive energy amongst the group sometimes about who's got the best teachings sort of thing. And the Buddha said, when people ask that, they should respond with the lion's roar, which sounds quite fierce, right? So the lion is roaring as a warning. That's what when the lion roars, it's a warning, like, oh, watch out, I'm here. And also, it shows both courage and strength, because a lion is a symbol of courage and strength. And so, they're supposed to reply with courage and strength. In other words, they don't want to sort of be, well, they're pretty much the same anyway, blah blah blah. They actually want to make a firm statement here. So I'm going to read chunks of the sutta and then comment on it and have some commentary on it from other sources as well. And so this is the first two verses were what I was just saying. So I'm actually starting with verse 3 here. It is possible, bhikkhus, that wanderers of other sects might ask, but on the strength of what argument, or with what support, or what authority do the venerable ones say this, say that this teaching is the correct one? Wanderers of other sects who ask thus may be answered in this way: friends, four things have been declared to us by the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened. On seeing these in ourselves, we say thus: only here is there a recluse, only here a second recluse, only here a third or a fourth recluse. The doctrines of others are devoid of recluses. In other words, the other doctrines don't lead to enlightenment. What are the four? We have confidence in the teacher. We have confidence in the Dhamma. We have fulfilled the precepts, and our companions in the Dhamma are dear and agreeable to us, whether they are laymen or those gone forth. These are four things declared to us by the Blessed One, who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened. One seeing which is in ourselves, we say as we do. So they're basically saying that they follow the precepts. And if you look at the other thing, they're talking about the precepts, they're also looking about the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. Oh, wait, that means they've taken refuge, right? When we take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. And then, of course, what the other sadhus, it is possible, because that wanderers of other sects may say thus: friends, we too have confidence in the teacher, that is, in our teacher. We too have confidence in the Dhamma, that is, our Dhamma. We too have fulfilled the precepts, that is, our precepts, and our companions in the Dhamma are dear and agreeable to us, too, whether they are laymen or those gone forth. What is the distinction here, friends? What is the variance? What is the difference between you and us? So, these guys are going to respond, well, we do all exactly what you're talking about. I mean, there's no difference. And so the Buddha then has to go on and sort of go into more detail. So this is quite a lengthy section I'm going to read here. Wanderers of other sects who ask thus may be answered in this way. How then, friends, is the goal one or many? Answering rightly, the wanderers of other sects would answer thus. Friends, the goal is one, not many. But friends, is that goal for one affected by lust or free from lust? Answering rightly, the wanderers of other sects answer thus. Friends, that goal is for one free from lust, not for one affected by lust. But friend, is that goal for one affected by hate or free from hate? Answering rightly, they answer, friend, that goal is for one free from hate, not for one not affected by hate. But friends, is that goal for one affected by delusion or free from delusion? Answering rightly, they would answer, friends, that goal is for one free from delusion, not for one affected by delusion. But friends, is that goal for one affected by craving or free from craving? Answering rightly, they would answer, friends, that goal is one free of craving. But friends, is that goal one affected by clinging or free from clinging? Answering rightly, they would answer, friends, that goal is one free from clinging, not for one affected by clinging. But friends, is that goal for one who has vision or one without vision? Answering rightly, they would answer, friends, that goal is for one with vision, not for one without vision. But friends, is that goal for one who favors and opposes, or for one who does not favor and oppose? Answering rightly, they would answer, friends, that goal is for one who does not favor and oppose. But friends, is that goal for one who delights and enjoys in proliferation, or one for one who does not enjoy proliferation? Answering rightly, they would answer, friends, that goal is for one who does not enjoy proliferation. So he's going through a long list of things. You know, the first ones, they're free from greed, hatred, and delusion. They're not affected by the what's classically called the three poisons. And then he's sort of talking about different flavors of that. Craving is another phrase for these things. Proliferation is, he's talking about the idea that often when we start, where something arises in our sense fields, we start thinking about it, and then we proliferate on it. We literally start from that one thing, leads to another thing, leads to another, and we're gone. This is the Pali word papancha that describes this quite precisely. It's like, and he's saying that there are people who don't do those things. And then, of course, the other bhikkhus from the other traditions say, yeah, but we do all that too. You know, and the Buddha admits, as he admits that these other sects may have equal regard or understanding of these things. Okay, and he goes on. Bhikkhus, there are two views, the view of being and the view of non-being. Any recluse or Brahmins who rely on the view of being, adopt the view of being, accept the view of being, are opposed to the view of non-being. Any recluses or Brahmins who rely on the view of non-being, adopt the view of non-being, accept the view of non-being, are opposed to the view of being. So he's saying this is this idea of not-self. Any recluse or Brahmin who does not understand as they actually are the origin, the disappearance, the gratification, the danger, and the escape. This is a list of how people reach enlightenment. They start to see that everything is changing all the time, essentially. And then they, through that they understanding, they escape from the clinging to. Okay. I'll go back here. I got distracted myself. In the case of these two views are affected by lust, affected by hate, affected by delusion, affected by craving, afflicted by clinging, affected without vision, given to favoring and opposing, and are delighted to and enjoy proliferation, they are not freed from birth, aging, and death, from sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. They are not freed from suffering, I say. So he's saying if they don't follow these important things, then they're caught. They're not free from suffering. They're not going to become enlightened. And then, of course, he says, yeah, but, of course, these other people in these other traditions understand that too. So he keeps coming, listing, here's the things that you need to know and practice and express as a bhikkhu, as a disciple of the Buddha. But admitting as that these other teachings are similar. They may express them in different ways, but they're the same thing. And he goes on. Any recluses or Brahmins who understand as they actually are the origins, the disappearance, the gratification, the dangers, and the escape, in the case of these two views, are without lust, without hate, without delusion, without craving, without clinging. They are freed from birth, etc. But then he goes on, but I got to make sure you understand what clinging is, right? Clinging is, and basically the second noble truth says, if we suffer, we are caught by the fact that we cling to things. Because there are four kinds of clinging. What are the four? Clinging to sensual pleasures, clinging to views, clinging to rules and observances, and clinging to the doctrine of self. And so I want to spend this. So this is a famous list. This is the list of the things we cling to, right? And I want to take some time to look at these in a little more detail here. Basically, in the sutta here, the Buddha goes on at length to expand on all these, but I'm not going to read all the sutta because you can see the sort of the repetitive nature of it to a certain extent. But let's look at so the first one, we cling to sense pleasures through objects. We somehow keep thinking that the next hit, the next sensory experience will be the one that lasts, that makes us permanently happy. Like we somehow think if we could just figure it out and get everything lined up just perfectly so that everything gave us pleasure and nothing was unpleasant, then everything would be fine. And we somehow, if we're really smart, we should be able to figure this out. We should be able to figure out how to have nothing but pleasure. And we keep thinking that the next thing we experience that's pleasurable will be the thing that holds it all together somehow. Doesn't work, of course. it's like a dog led around by his nose. Ever seen dogs, or they just, as they're out walking, they're sort of sniffing, oh, here's something good over here, and then they wander, and they sniff something over there, oh, there's something even better over here, And that's the nature of dogs. It's like they're just literally led around by the nose. If I can only find the right smell, then I'll be a happy dog. This is what we do. I don't want to say that we're all dogs, and I know in Boulder this is dangerous because dogs in Boulder are sacred animals and all that. But it's like we have to be. But it's like this is how we cling. We cling because we think somehow or other we'll find it, the right combination of stuff, that everything's going to be great all the time. There's a wonderful, in this is Joseph's books, The Experience of Insight, and he has this great story. There's a story about Mulla Nasruddin, a famous Sufi teaching figure. One day he went to the market and saw a big bushel of hot chili peppers on sale. He bought them, returned home, and began to eat them. A while later, his disciples came and saw the mullah with tears streaming down his face, his mouth and tongue burning. "Mullah, mullah, why do you keep on eating them?" As he reached for another, Nasruddin replied, I keep waiting for a sweet one. This is what we do. We keep waiting. Somehow we're going to find the sweet one in the basket of hot peppers. It's a great image, I think. And what he was, of course, was pointing to is that's what how people live in the world. They get caught by this idea that there's going to be a sweet one in this basket. So that's the first of the four that the Buddha listed, the things we cling to. Clinging to views. I'm sure you've probably heard me talk about this before, but it's like so central to the Buddhist teachings. And basically, views and opinions are partly cultural things, how we grew up, and partly, sort of more intellectual, what we've decided how things should be. We get it set in our mind that things should be a certain way. People should act in a certain way. How people treat me, should they should treat me in a certain way. How what's true, really true, absolutely true, and what isn't absolutely true, in fact is wrong. These are all views and opinions that we act based on these views and opinions all the time. And the problem, of course, is these views and opinions are, though they have elements of truth in them sometimes, often they're just like total nonsense. But because that's how we grew up, how I was taught as a child, or how the political party I belong to, or the religious sect I belong to, or whatever. The dance group I belong to that says that dan if you're going to dance, you can only dance this way, any other way would be wrong. And then you get actually people get in big arguments about the correct way to dance. I mean, it's absurd as it might seem, that's actually true. And the problem with views and opinions is, unlike sensory experience, which is pretty easy to understand, often these things are so sort of deeply ingrained, they're habitual patterns of thought that have this sort of flavor of, well, of course, that's how it's always been. Well, or well, everybody knows that's right. Right. Or says we when you hear yourself saying phrases like that to yourself or to someone else, sort of go, let the sort of the yellow warning light should start blinking on your mental dashboard. It's like, is that really true? Or is that just true because that's how I've always been told it was true? And you think about a lot of the trouble in the world. Just look at anything that's going on in the world now where there's all kinds of conflict on a variety of things. Most of it comes from people holding views and opinions and thinking theirs are the right ones, and those other people's views and opinions are the wrong ones. And if it's just sort of a little intellectual discussion, that doesn't do a lot of harm, but a lot of people act, speak, and act from this place and cause untold suffering in the world. I mean, my favorite example of this is at one point in England, there was they had a 100 years war about this in England. This is in the 1600s or something like that, where one group said that the when you take communion, the wine and the wafer actually become the body and the blood of Christ. And the other group said, no, they're only symbolic of. And people fought a war about this. But this is, I mean, it goes on and on. Like you can find hundreds of examples of this today. Right now, today, there's stuff going on in the world that this is exactly what's going on. And it's because people cling to their views and opinions. The views and opinions are like, think of them as filters on reality. There's like what's actually happening, what's actually there, and how we see it once we filter it through our personal I sets of views and opinions that we know are the right ways to think and act and speak. The third of these, rites and rituals. This is in the Buddhist time, this was a much bigger issue, I think, though it's still true today in certain ways. In the Buddhist time, the whole of North India, where he was teaching, was basically ruled. The predominant culture was the Brahmanic culture. The Brahmins were the top of the four castes, and everything else came as secondary to the Brahmins. The Brahmins were the ones who were in charge. You couldn't do anything, you couldn't grow a crop, you couldn't get married, you couldn't get buried, you couldn't do anything without a Brahmin saying the right prayers and rituals, and of course you paying the Brahmin to do this. And so the whole of the culture was totally ritualistic. And the Brahmins, of course, had these big, huge, thick books called the Vedas, which laid out in great detail all these rituals that, of course, only the Brahmins could read. So no one else could learn the rituals and perform them themselves. They were forced to depend on the Brahmins. And the Buddha said, "Nah, not true," which really upset the Brahmins, needless to say. And he was like, he would take anybody from any caste and initiate them. This was like shocking. Only Brahmins are supposed to be, doing this sort of stuff. And he was taking like outcast, not only from the other three castes, but from outcasts, people who were like lower than the lowest caste of workers, people who had been thrown out. He also took women, which was equally shocking. Because women were like, "No, I'm sorry, you just have to wait till the next lifetime when you get a male body, and then you can practice and study." That was the traditional culture, and he was just ignored all of that. But how did so? That's like back then. That's what it was like, and it's, by the way, still is in India, and sad to say, actually, in North America now, where people have immigrated from India, and there is still this caste and class structure going on in all kinds of sometimes not so subtle ways right here in North America with people who are im recent immigrants and descendants of those cult that culture. It's another set of views and opinions, right? But it's a specialized one that has sort of religious overtones and has a certain very traditional form. What about the rest of us Westerners? What does this mean for us? And I think, having, and I'm allowed to say this because I was a hippie, right? That the way there's a whole spiritual culture in our world, in our Western world, that has all kinds of views and opinions like this that people cling to, that cause untold suffering. The one that upsets me the most, and this comes out of my work as a chaplain in the hospital, because I encounter this from time to time, where someone will say, someone's sick, quite ill, and someone will say to them, "Well, this is, you brought this on. This is your fault that you're sick. That you, this is somehow or other through your karma from past lives or because of how you've lived in this life or whatever, or just how you've been thinking and living, this is the result of your life expressed as this illness." Which is total nonsense, of course. But people really believe this, and people say this to people. I've actually had to, like, want to sort of go to someone as they're saying this to a patient I'm sitting with. I don't want to go, "No, get out of here. You can't say that," because it's nonsense. Because you're blaming people for stuff that's totally random. I mean, and it is true to a certain extent, people do live lifestyles that make it more likely they're going to get sick. And I can't deny that either. But it's like to say, no, this is all written in the cards. It's all your karma. It's all who you are. It's like whatever, all these variations on a theme. It's just, this is a like, these are views and opinions that have this sort of spiritual overlay that makes them true, of course, because they're spiritual, right? That are just cause all kinds of grief. And I could give you other examples, but that's the one that's always on my mind because I encounter it in my day-to-day life. So the Buddha's in the sutta, the Buddha goes through these three layers of clinging. And then he says, just like for all the other things he said, but of course, the monks will say, well, yeah, that's how we believe too. That's our teaching. And so at this point, the Buddha says, yes, but how about that fourth form of clinging? And this, what the fourth thing we cling to is our sense of a separate self. The sense that somehow we're separate from everyone else. That this whole teaching on not self that the Buddha emphasizes so strongly, it's like sort of, in some senses, the central teaching of everything. And I've been talking about this off and on for weeks now, but here I am again at the same place where this idea of not self is central to the Buddha's teachings, and it's the thing that we cling to, this sense of a separate self. I want to read a couple of things here. This is from, once again, from Joseph Goldstein's book, The Experience of Insight, and this is his actual words on this particular form of clinging. The fourth of the bonds, and the most subtle, the most deeply conditioned, is our attachment to the belief in self, in I, in me, in mine. The belief that there is some permanent entity in the mind body which is experiencing all of this. Because of this belief, and to satisfy the I, the self, we get involved in all kinds of unwholesome actions, all kinds of greed and hatred, all kinds of delusion, for the gratification of the self, which isn't even there. Our attachment to the concept of self is so great that everything we do revolves about it. That's a pretty strong statement, huh? Everything we do revolves about this sense of separate self. Tying the bond even tighter to this mass of suffering. So what he's saying very firmly is that this is the thing that is the most difficult thing to deal with, because it's like we keep going, oh, well, of course I'm separate. I mean, what do you mean I'm not separate? It's like, this is my body and that's your body over there, and my stuff and your stuff, and my thoughts and your thoughts, and we keep getting caught in that place of seeing that there's something different there, as opposed to seeing that underneath those external differences, there's this continuity of total connection and no difference at all. And I can say that, but it's having to not just say it, but actually understand it and take it in at some deeper non-intellectual level. That's what this practice is trying to get us to. More than anything else, that's what this practice is about. We're heading to a place where that becomes our understanding, our what keeps us going, in a sense, to the practice. That's another of Joseph's books that also has something to say. And now he's talking about craving again. The Buddha spoke, the second kind of craving the Buddha spoke of goes deeper than the craving for sense pleasure. It's called craving for becoming, for renewed existence. Like, we keep wanting to continue. We want to be renewed. I mean, because literally every second things are changing. We've got to the point where we sort of take that in. But then we think, but I want to be solid. I want to keep going. I don't want to die, in whatever sense that mean that is. This is a very basic urge or desire to be. It is the desire for continuing existence, particularly in pleasant realms. We may or may not believe in rebirth and different planes of existence, although they are mentioned often in the Buddhist teachings. But we do have to believe in them in order to, but we don't have to believe to them in order to experience this powerful craving for becoming. We can see it in the planning mind, in the act of imagining ourselves in some future situation. We might be planning for something at work or perhaps for our next vacation. It all starts with just a thought, and then weeks or months or even years later, a whole chain of thoughts and actions has materialized in our lives. Notice how often we get lost in mind fantasies of a future self. I'll do this. I'll go there. Losing ourselves in these projects is a manifestation of craving for becoming. This is like, we have this idea of what we're going to be like in the future or what's going to happen in the future. And that's sort of taking, that means this self I have now has to remain permanent till I get there. That's the issue here. It's like, and I'm not saying, of course, that we don't have to plan and do things like, oh, yeah, I need to go shopping tomorrow. I better make a shopping list now. Well, we live in the world. We have to do that sort of stuff. But when we start to believe that somehow or other, those plans, those ideas of what's going to happen in the future are absolutely true. They're going to happen. That's when we create our own suffering. Because, of course, stuff happens and all those plans we had, gone. Just like that. You know, I'm planning to go to Santa Fe tomorrow to be with my son and daughter-in-law and have a little vacation, a little family vacation. And yeah, I've had to plan that and organize it and get, you know, tickets and figure out what time I have to leave the house to get to the airport on time and all that sort of stuff. But if I believe absolutely that that's true, it's going to happen. And then I wake up in the morning and I'm sick. Or I wake up in the morning and all the flights have been grounded because of a terrorist attack. I mean, who knows what stuff happens, right? And if I can't at that point just go, okay, that's what happened. The things, if I believe absolutely they're going to happen and then they don't happen, which is quite often actually with plans and those sorts of things, then we just make ourselves suffer over and over and over again. Just through that sense of I'm going to exist then and this is what's going to happen then. And it's so normal that we do that. And as I said, it's actually to live in the world that we have to do that to function as regular day-to-day householder human beings. But it's when we believe absolutely that what we think is going to happen is true, that's when we set ourselves up over and over again for suffering. Because we don't know. We really have no clue. Ah, okay. So there's one other flavor of this. I just want to mention this. And that's the what's called the craving for non-existence. The craving that people have to no longer live, to be, and this could be because they're unhappy with their life, or they have some idea that when this body goes, I'm going to be in some magical, wonderful place where everything's going to be great all the time. I'm going to be in heaven, or some form of heaven. This is directly related to this, to having a sense of self. Because if this self can stop, then everything is going to be great. And once again, I go back to, I was just talking to someone today who just got diagnosed with liver cancer, and he's 80 years old, and he's probably going to die. And he said to me quite openly, he said, "But it's okay, because I know I'm going to heaven, because I've been a good Christian all my life, and I'm fine with that." And this is like, oh, from my sort of hospital chaplain point of view, this is good. It keeps him happy. But he's in for a big shock, I think, when he actually passes away and doesn't end up in there and with the angels blowing their trumpets. Whatever is going to happen to him, I don't think that's what's going to happen to him. So once again, sometimes those sort of beliefs are useful in our lives and the world. But the other side of this craving for non-existence is, I can't stand my life in the world, so I'll just end it, which happens all the time as well. And that is just the ultimate in delusion, that somehow that's going to make everything better. Ending it right now is going to make it better. Anyhow, I won't say anything more about that. It's too present in my mind because of other things that are going on. But here's the interesting thing. It's this sense of not self, these teachings on non-self. In the sutta, the Buddha says, this is the thing that no one else teaches. This is what's unique to the Buddhist teaching. This is what's unique to my teaching. And when you roar your lion's roar, this is what it can be based on. Because it's this understanding that leads to enlightenment. It's having this not intellectual knowledge, but actually experiential knowing leads to a place of enlightenment. And it's not easy. I'm not pretending at all that this is an easy subject. I mean, I'm sure you've heard me say this before, but the Buddha, he's sitting there under the Bodhi tree, and he's, got rid of everything else. He's not craving anything. All these other things he's talking about. But he said the last thing he had to deal with was a subtle sense of a separate self. It's the last thing he let go of before enlightenment finally arose. So this is like central to the teaching, but it's also, we have to sort of take little tiny bits of it, hopefully. Absorb it a little bit more, and a little bit more. Because that's the only way we can grasp it. There is, I want to read a little bit more. And just, now, these four kinds of clinging have what as their source? What is their origin? From what are they born and produced? These four kinds of clinging have craving as their source, craving as their origin. They are born and produced from craving. Craving has what as its source? Craving has feeling, vedana, as its source. Feeling has contact as its source. Contact has what as its source? Contact has the fact that we have senses. So he's going back through the 12 factors. And he's saying, you cling because you have experiences. Oh, darn. That's, it's like, He's saying it's inevitable that you're going to have experiences. You're going to have something's going to rise at one of the sense doors. Contact is made. Vedana is going to arise, which is going to be pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. And based on those pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral Vedanas, you're going to fall into craving and clinging. This is the nature of being human. And so, what we're learning to do with this practice, in some sense, is short circuit that process a little bit. That's what we have to learn to do. And not just continually, every time something arises in one of the sense doors and contact arises and Vedana arises, we don't just blindly follow the impulse of the Vedana. Once again, I'm not talking about something that's easy. But he said that's where clinging, all our clinging arises in that chain, simply from things arising at the sense doors. And we have to understand that we can't like say, okay, I'm just going to stop clinging. That's like saying, no, I'm not going to have any senses anymore. We can't just turn it off. We have to be aware of it. We have to see it arising. We have to, through practice, gradually not get caught so often. And over time, over time, over time, over time, we'll cling less. That's the best we can do, is to cling less and less and less as we more and more see those patterns, those habitual patterns arising over and over and over again. But then the Buddha says, Bhikkhus, when ignorance is abandoned and true knowledge has arisen in a bhikkhu, then with the fading away of ignorance and the arising of true knowledge, he no longer clings to sensual pleasure. He no longer clings to views. He no longer clings to rules and observances. He no longer clings to a doctrine of self. When he does not cling, he is not agitated. When he is not agitated, he personally attains nibbana. He understands birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what has to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being, which is the classical language that you'll see repeated over and over and over it throughout the Buddhist suttas to say, you just became enlightened. It's a classical expression of that. And so what he's saying is if we just stop clinging, then we can reach enlightenment, which is really, this is in some sense just a repetition of the second and third noble truths, this whole sutta. Now he's saying, what's the problem? Because the second noble truth says we suffer because we cling. The third noble truth says just stop. And then he says, yeah, but, and then he goes on to how we have to learn to do that. And when we do that, then and nibbana, enlightenment arises. And what's important, I think, is that if we stop a little bit, then a little bit of enlightenment arises. We stop a little bit more, a little more. It's not an on-off switch. It's a long-term, gradual process. And we, if we can just catch it a little bit, and then a little bit, and then a little bit, start to see how our views and opinions affect how we're acted in the world. Start seeing how our, quote, spiritual ideas are sometimes leading us astray. Start seeing how our desire for physical pleasures sometimes leads us astray. And gradually start to see how this idea that we're separate causes us to suffer. If we can start gradually to see those things over time, we suffer less, we struggle less, we have more moments of calm and peace, more moments that are enlightenment-like until somehow that shift occurs, or so I've been told. I'm not speaking from experience here. One last thing. It's a little bit of poetry always expresses these things better. This is from Dana Fald's book, Going In. It's called Staring at the Bones. Sooner or later, life in its variety and wisdom chews the meat from the bones of my illusions. It sucks the marrow from inside and throws the dry bone to bleach in a pile. Expectations are treated with equal disdain. Stripped of their finery, they are revealed as nothing more than future plans, easy ways to stay safe, roadmaps drawn by a blind cartographer, trying to imagine distant destinations. This is the present moment's boot camp. Life's lack of rules will be obeyed, or I'll spend my time peeling potatoes in the past. I can choose to leave behind the skeletons of what I thought I knew and raise the flag of truth on the front porch. I can take a single step and wait for the next one to be revealed. I can only know where I am in this moment. Anything else is a desperate attempt to clothe the bones and start them walking. This is a pretty clear expression of what I've been trying to say, I think.